All right, welcome to the MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me is James. Josh will be joining us in a minute to talk about the Oscar ceremony, but when Josh disappears, we will be talking about the film 12 Years a Slave, so you can probably skip to about the 45-minute mark if you have no interest in hearing talking about the Oscar ceremony, but it was a fun conversation, so maybe you'll enjoy it. But yeah, we're going to have other content coming up. We've had a lot of content recently. We talked about the Lego movie last, I believe, and Black Mirror, series 1 and 2. And next week, we're going to be talking about True Detective. Hopefully, we'll be able to post that podcast on Monday after the finale. But yeah, be sure to stay tuned to everything that we do. And follow us at the MacGuffinmen, all one word, to be able to follow us. Anyways, theme song, and then Josh, and then 12 Years a Slave.
Welcome to the MacGuffinmen. And now, here are Alex and James.
Well, you fucked it up, Josh.
Welcome. Did I do something?
Welcome to the MacGuffin, man.
Shit.
I'm Alex, and with me is both Josh and James. Josh is a return guest. I believe we last had you on the podcast when we talked about Purple Rain.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And today we will be talking about the Oscars, which is a similar level of enjoyment.
Intro for me?
And absurdity.
Well, we all know who you are, James.
Okay.
You're old news.
Josh is a guest. We have to be nice to him.
Thank you.
All right, so the Oscars were, as we're recording this, last night. And I know two of us watched. I assume, Josh, you watched as well.
I faded in and out.
Okay. Because of naps, or you just did other things?
No, I passed out because of the glamour and the opulence.
You couldn't handle Anne Hathaway's
dress. It was overwhelming. Oh, so shiny. Just beautiful stuff.
All right, so I suppose the place to start is just general impressions of the show.
Jimmy, you want to take this one away?
It's James here, Josh. Have some respect.
Damn it. No, good start. This is a real good start.
overall, not too impressed. I like Ellen in general, but I didn't think she was fantastic by any means. Played it nice and safe, which did not surprise me by any means, but I could have used a little bit more from her, I guess. And yeah, I mean, normal too long, and yeah, some easily cuttable montages that
montages
made no sense.
About nothing.
Yeah.
Here's Chris Evans talking about heroes for a second. Now we'll just show you clips of superheroes because this is adding something.
Yeah, I didn't quite get that. I think everyone always looks for things to cut out, and they just added some fluff in with very little reason, in my opinion. So it's my general takeaway.
Yeah.
Joshua?
I enjoyed the what I assume is probably the most singularly scripted event on television in the calendar year, coming across as though Ellen was literally making it up on the moment at any given moment. She has this ability to talk as though I'm talking right now, where she's like, well, maybe we'll have another performer. I don't know. Here's Matthew. And then, like, she's obviously reading these, like, cards that are on her hand. Matthew McConaughey. That's all right. That's another thing I noticed, too, is that I'm assuming the teleprompter was written in size 4.5 font.
I have so many questions about the teleprompter from last night.
Insanity. Like, and I mean, there are characters that I assume just screwed it. Like, John Travolta did it on his own.
Yeah.
But there are a few people that you could tell were, like, having a significant problem physically reading English.
Yeah, it was so bizarre. And, like, I'm trying to figure out, because it seemed like a lot of words were split, like, in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to cause a lot of problems, specifically Kristen B. L., which was funny by itself, and then Ellen's immediate reaction was really funny.
I think that's a legitimate joke she knew she was going to
okay.
do.
Okay, I hope so.
Well, Michael B. Jordan, Christian B. L.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
That one makes
you're
sense.
You're way too much credit.
I just think, given all the other teleprompter issues throughout the evening.
Oh, yeah, no, that's not an isolated incident, but that one, I think, made the most sense to be somewhat planned.
Yeah, for sure, that does make sense. And I don't know, because, like, I mean, teleprompter is kind of a tough job because it's a weird, like, pacing thing you have to keep going, but I would think for the Oscars, you've found somebody that's worked a teleprompter before, and I don't know, wouldn't make John Travolta call Idina Menzel whatever it was that he called Idina Menzel.
Oh, Adele Dazeem.
Yeah, that was it.
Middle Eastern singing sensation. Adele Dazeem? You guys haven't heard of her? Oh, Jesus. She was just a delight. The look on her face when she came out after that was one of just complete disillusionment with reality.
I thought they were going to say my name before I came out.
And then, sorry.
No, I just thought, when she came out, I'm assuming she was thinking about all the Tonys she'd won. Just thought, they're garbage. They're useless awards. I can pack it in.
We got to hear the term EGOT used.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, we've got new EGOTers and an announcement by the Oscars that we now have a new EGOTer. And I like that a lot.
Is that a 30 Rock exclusive? Like, did they coin that term?
I don't think they coined the term, but I think it was mentioned because of 30 Rock.
Because that impressed me. I thought that was like a deep cut 30 Rock reference.
No, EGOT was a term that existed pre 30 Rock.
Oh, all right. I don't believe that, but I'll take it.
Okay. What about that time Alan said, did he just call me pumpkin?
Yeah.
Was that a 30 Rock thing too?
No. I think this whole night was based loosely around like seasons 4 through 6 of 30 Rock. That was the thematic approach that Ellen was taking at the beginning.
And the pilot, and specifically the pilot.
Ooh, specifically the pilot before they hired the woman that played Jenna Maroney, like Rachel Dratch on there.
The unaired version of the pilot where Rachel Dratch was still in it as a main character.
As anyone that anyone wants to see on television.
And I think Dennis Duffy did the montages for the whole thing.
Yeah, definitely. While watching an Islanders game, he didn't even give it his whole...
Yeah. Here's a question I have for both of you guys. What was the highlight of the evening for you?
Maybe Brad Pitt handing out pizza plates with, like, it in all sincerity. He just seems like the nicest, politest human being ever who does not need to be that way anymore. And just him in the background individually handing out paper plates and making sure he got everybody and not caring about if he's in frame was wonderful.
Excellent.
Yeah. I think my favorite part came just before the actual broadcast started. And James, I pointed this out to you. I forget who was getting interviewed, but somebody that wasn't Joseph Gordon-Levitt was getting interviewed near Joseph Gordon-Levitt's seat. And just in the background, kind of out of focus, I guess it was JGL's publicist or whatever, just starts like wiping the back of his hand on Joseph Gordon-Levitt's face. And I assumed to get rid of something that was there. And then he stopped and then started again. And it was amazing.
It was backhand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was definitely backhand.
Especially weird. Yeah. And that there were 6 of individual strokes on another face.
And that there was clearly a camera right next to them. What's going on?
Focused.
I thought that was great. I thought Jared Leto making sure that we all know that while he's partying with Leonardo DiCaprio and Matthew McConaughey, they're only really thinking about Ukraine and Venezuela. I really appreciated that Jared Leto. I would throw that in.
Thank God that we know he is, because if he wasn't, who else would? If he wasn't there to guide us like the proverbial political North Star towards just the human rights, if we didn't have supporting actors on this planet, we would just all be lost.
That is a good point.
I was hoping the night would be even more political. That's what I really like to wait. Like, I really like to sit back and hope against hope that they start talking about, like, the Keystone Pipeline. And Kate Blanchett really lays it down for us.
What was your highlight, Josh?
Well, my highlight was the fact that Liza Minnelli was there. Just the fact that she was – they let her out of whatever home she has been cajoled into, and someone tricked her into a dress, and she got there because any time the camera came on her, she looked as though it was her first day under the yellow sun, and she had not seen the light before. And it was everything. Every time it was the best.
Yeah, she's a superstar.
Oh, she's a delight. And Ellen called her a man. Her face. And no one in the crowd even gave it a second. Everyone in the crowd just went, oh, sick burn.
Ellen has that kind of cachet built up, though. She's got that goodwill more than she needs.
What an absolute delight.
I thought when they started talking about Somewhere Over the Rainbow, we were going to get Liza Minnelli performance.
Well, they mentioned
don't even tease me.
They mentioned her and the two other people she was sitting with as being a part of the Wizard of Oz.
Liza Minnelli and some people she knows. I think they also came out of Judy Garland.
I was pretty heavily tapped out by that point as far as paying attention. I feel I'm blaming my Michael B. Jordan mishap on that as well.
Fair enough.
I have a question for you guys. Is there a reason? And you guys might. I think
my answer immediately is no.
Okay, all right, good. Is there a reason? I think you guys are fans of this person, so forgive me if I'm treading on any toes. But is there a reason
that Midler?
Jamie Foxx is allowed anywhere near the Oscars
because he's won an Oscar.
Is it like a lifetime ticket?
I think it's like winning the Masters. You can play.
Theater right now, just sitting there eating like noodles.
And even just being nominated for two Oscars is basically the same as winning, which is the only explanation for Glenn Close featured so prominently as well.
Was Glenn Close there?
Yes.
Well, I did not see her.
She was there presenting an award in like the last hour. I don't remember what the award was, but
oh my God, I had shut down at that point. Was it DeVille?
Yes, she did. She did it all as Cruella de Vil.
She came out with 101 puppies.
Yep.
But anyway, if I could change one thing about the Oscars, that would be Jamie Foxx doesn't come there and awkwardly hit on his own daughter. Because it something about it is so repulsive to me.
Yeah, one of his red carpet interviews, he was talking about his daughter's legs a lot, and it was really weird.
Every interview in the last 4 years Jamie Foxx has, he goes, oh, can you believe, look how fucking hot my daughter is? And I go, like, who? No, sorry, I had to get that off my chest.
That's fine.
It's the worst.
Yeah, you don't have to think that you're the weirdo for fighting this incestuous hitting on thing.
Okay.
Weird.
I do, because so many people, like, I have friends that I will mention that to, and they will go, like, they'll give me, like, the leave Jamie Foxx alone look.
Oh, my God.
Like, he's just like trying.
He's the kind of talent that we can't talk shit about,
yeah,
apparently.
Like, you need to respect him. Like, he's broken barriers. He was Ray Charles, Josh. Like,
he was in Held Up with Nia Long. We need to leave him out of this.
And people like Jamie Foxx, not the same respect they have for Daniel Day-Lewis, but he's just too fun and musical that people give him passes on a lot of things.
I know, and I've spoken very positively about elements of Jamie Foxx in the past, but
I'll take a pass on it, the whole thing.
That's fine.
Whole package, top to bottom. Sorry, James. It's James okay. Foxx. I'm formal with James Foxx.
Very formal.
I loved Naomi Watts when she was talking about special effects with Samuel L. Jackson, how the person that wrote what they were reading mentioned tsunamis and doing the impossible, both of which are obvious references to the tsunami movie called The Impossible that Naomi Watts was in, and nobody got it because everybody has forgotten that movie existed. But I loved that they tried to force that movie back into our lives.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, everyone is too distracted by Sammy.
Yeah, exactly. By the apparent worry that he will say motherfucker live on television.
I was
voiced in our viewing room.
Oh, wouldn't that would have just burned the place to the ground.
But he did it for Venezuela, guys.
For the truth.
We need to talk about Bette Midler.
Do we?
Yes.
Bette E. Midler.
Okay. So let me tell you guys, this is coming from my perspective.
Great.
The obituary thing wrapped up, and I thought that was a solemn, classy obit section.
Nice, tasteful, quiet.
Tasteful, quick, quiet, and everybody started clapping, and then the fucking thing went up. And out comes Bette Midler, who I think did that song unscripted. I think she saw the EBIT thing from the crowd and thought, now is my time. And she wrestled a mic away from somebody. And she was on the stage and they just said, go with it.
She said, plug in my iPod. I've got the karaoke version of the song on there at all times.
Because... oh man, was that? And I swear to God, I love Bette Midler to death, but that was gut wrenching.
Yeah, Alex kind of pointed out going right from the obituary section to doing a performance of your own and then just bathing in all the applause that comes after.
Oh, that was the worst classless part.
Like, washed over her.
Like, at the end of the standing ovation, she very clearly thought the ovation was for her and not all of the dead people. Like,
wasn't it, though?
Oh, I couldn't believe... And the, like, wings she was doing at the end were insane. It was just so bizarre.
Oh, like an eagle.
Ugh.
Yeah. I get it.
That song got chosen because it is a sad song, but if the lyrics of the song are very disrespectful to the recently dead insofar as it's like, you were this thing that helped me get here.
Oh, it's so appropriate.
It's like thank you so much, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Without your heroin death, I wouldn't be singing this song. It is, and I thought that's not at all appropriate.
No, she's just meta like that, though.
You think so?
She gets it.
She's breaking down the fourth Hollywood wall.
Yeah.
Which is dignity.
Well, I think a lot of people want her to be in the in memoriam section next year, but in a slightly different place.
Oh, she'll outlive us all. She will.
Even Liza?
Liza's mostly plastic as it is. So.
Well, speaking of mostly plastic, let's talk about Kim Novak, early adopter of plastic surgery.
I want to give... This is where I... Personal Oscar of the evening.
Okay.
I want to give my first Oscar of the evening out for best adapted necromancy at the man that assembled the necessary materials for the ritual needed to fucking claim Kim Novak back from the crypt and bring her up on stage with Matthew McConaughey.
And what a wonderful pairing.
Oh my God. I've never been more horrified in my life.
Matthew McConaughey basically saying, I used to jerk off to you in Vertigo, to her face.
And with his face, he didn't smile once through that whole thing. Because he thought, how long will I have to be up here until this ends? And he could also see the face of death in her. The specter of death literally, like, swinging around as they paid, like, a beautiful tribute to the Weekend at Bernie's.
And I love how he pulled her close to the mic at the towards the end of her speech.
And assured everyone in the crowd that she was all right.
I now kind of want the next True Detective to be Matthew McConaughey and Kim Novak, but Matthew McConaughey is basically like pulling her around and trying to get her closer to the actual crime scene.
And she's the first murder victim.
Yeah. And also the killer.
And also immortal, so she just keeps coming back. Can we just do reignite the Highlander featuring Kim Novak? She just, with her impossibly tight skin, has to save the world. It looked, I swear to God, it looked like somebody wrapped a series of grocery bags with an elastic band.
Yeah.
And crumpled it all up and then animated it into a face. It was unbelievable. It was such a stark contrast to the rest of the night that it stood out. Like, I remember thinking as I was going to bed, I was thinking that was absurd.
And then she ate Jennifer Lawrence's soul to stay alive for two more years.
On national television.
Yep.
She gave her the Shang Tsung from Mortal Kombat.
Not okay with that reference. Definitely not okay that I got it.
Well, come on.
What happened to the money in Pharrell's hat?
Oh, this. Can we talk about this?
Yes.
I think that's what I just tried to do, Josh. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm so mad about this. This is something I was going to save until later, but goddamn. So Ellen brings the pizza out. And do you guys remember in Arrested Development, they always sort of rip on Lucille for not having any idea how much things cost in the real world?
Yes.
And then they go to Harvey Weinstein and Ellen asks him to pay for the pizzas. And they ordered three large pizzas and Harvey Weinstein gives her $200.
Yep.
In the most, like, offensive gesture I think I've ever seen in my entire life. Oh, Harvey, can you pick up the tab? And he pulled out this money from nowhere. Like, he was using it to hold his pants up. Tossed it in the hat in this way that said, I hope that covers it, because I am Harvey Weinstein and I have not bought something from a grocery store or a local business in 35 years.
Maybe he thought they were donating to Ukraine, though.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Jesus Christ, that makes it even worse if that's what he done. Oh, those poor Ukrainians all the way in South America. I don't really know.
I did love Ellen chirping Brad Pitt for not putting enough money in the Pharrell hat, and then him throwing money.
Well, it's a fine line, right?
Did you guys like that pizza bit? Did you think it had the appropriate levity, or did you think that it was just a disaster?
I thought all of the jokes about ordering the pizza fell flat, but I really enjoyed the actual handing out of the pizza.
Oh, I had that kind of concept as well. Like when she was talking about the pizza, everyone sort of just...
And the fact
that the celebrities devoured it.
Yeah.
Pretty indicative of the fact that they were all starving.
Yeah, it was pretty great. And watching Martin Scorsese taking a slice of pizza out of a box of pizza made me happy.
And like that pizza guy is just giving a slice of pizza to Martin Scorsese and going, oh, here you go, Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
That's for you.
One part about that I think really elevated the experience for me was how badly they botched the return from commercial right into that bit where they cut back to the feed just as the person saying applause please, and Ellen's mic is live and we can hear her talking to the delivery guy backstage just before they're coming out, and then there's an awkward 10 seconds of nothing happening and then them coming out. I feel like that added a nice element to the bit.
Yeah. I was hoping she would be a little racist to him. There was a part of me that thought, this is the time.
This is the unmasking of the real Ellen.
If Ellen DeGeneres is going to come out as a horrible racist, now is the moment. And I waited on the edge of my seat until she popped out, and I thought, not worth it.
She's pretty funny. We should see if she has Twitter, guys. We should get her on that tip.
So fresh and edgy. And you know there was about, I'm going to say 60% of the people in that audience had no idea what she was talking about. Yeah. They were just impressed she had a camera that could fit in her hand.
One thing I do, while we're on the topic of modern technology, I thought the speed with which so many people decided they were getting in the selfie, that made me pretty happy. And also Lupita Nyong'o's brother jumping in made me super happy.
Like the newest, biggest celebrity on the planet. This guy.
For having a famous sister.
Yeah.
Is it racist? And I just will. And this is always a bad question to start if I said it was racist. Yeah.
The answer is always yes. If the question starts with, is it racist?
They panned through.
Oh, you cut out. It was too racist to cut out.
Oh, well, you know what? Now I'm not going to say it because I feel like I'm tempting fate.
The internet just censored you. How does that feel?
You're
too racist for the World Wide Web.
Well, I'll just let your audience think I'm really edgy.
You're too edgy for us. We had to edit it.
Too edgy for the internet. Ugh. What did you guys think about the actual award distribution? Were there any big upsets in your mind, or did everybody kind of play out the way it should have?
I don't know. I guess it was surprising that Cate Blanchett won, kind of. Maybe. I don't even remember the other nominees that weren't named Meryl. Mm-hmm. But
Sandra,
I don't know.
Sandra Bullock?
Yeah, I guess.
I didn't think
That was Woody Allen's award.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt the writing award was going to go. I thought they were going to give them the writing award for that.
I think this is my assumption, of course, assuming all the backroom intricacies that go on in the Oscars. I assume that they just didn't want to mention his name at all, on national television.
That's what I mean. It's a good way around it. It's too direct to just give it right to him. And
yeah, so if you slide it to Kate and she gives him sort of a nod in the same way that somebody might thank Roman Polanski.
Yeah, she gives him a cut of the statue, just rips an arm off for him.
It's like the tiara at the end of Mean Girls. The cautious applause to the mention of Woody Allen. I got a kick out of that. Yeah. In her
speech. No one was sure.
Yeah.
Is it I'm the only one that assumes that on the edges of the theater is just a series of armed guards. And at any moment they will just take over the broadcast and shut everything down if the wrong thing gets said.
I don't know that the last part will happen, but I assume it's a pretty secure environment.
I assume it's how the Oscars would have been broadcast in Stalinist Russia. And they would just sweep in at any moment and just shut everything down.
Or
what?
It's politics.
What'd you say?
modern Russia, politics.
Yeah.
Oh, so topical. Thank God. But yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I don't know if you guys are going to be jealous about this, but I did totally dominate my Oscar poll.
Okay.
So I got everything except Best Supporting Actor. I had my money on Barkhad Abdi.
Oh, I would have loved that.
Right? That would have been all right.
Yeah. My hope was for anybody but Jared Leto, but I did quite enjoy Barkhad.
I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah, he was great. James liked him as well.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I did not see 12 Years a Slave, I'll admit that. But from what I've heard about 12 Years a Slave, Lupita Nyong'o is in it for like 38 seconds.
She has a small role.
Yeah. And this offended some of my friends that thought somebody who was actually in a movie should have gotten Best Supporting Actress.
She was in the movie.
Your racist, your racism was covered with your last comment. Yeah, when that got censored.
God damn it. I wanted Barkhad Abdi to win. I can't be.
But didn't William Hurt win an Oscar for like 4 minutes of screen time? So I feel like anything is possible.
Oh, I'll give it to him. She was adorable, and her speech was the best one out of the night.
Her speech was pretty good. I like the. I'm partial to Matthew McConaughey's just for. The two portions I really loved, number one being him talking about his dad, and number two being him saying, all right, all right, all right, in a totally confident, totally self-aware way at the end.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
Yeah. What he said, just keep living at the end as well. It's great.
I feel like I just don't like him as a human being, so I can't get over it, especially after that conversation he had with himself on stage about how he is his own hero in 10 years. Which I
but
thought
in 10 years, that's the humble way to be your own hero.
Oh, that was a nightmare.
Yeah, I get where he's coming from, but it's like for a night that people say is about Hollywood just being so self-congratulatory and being up its own ass, that really summed it up very nicely.
I was hoping he was going to say literally anything else other than himself.
Yeah. I would have been fine with that.
I would have.
Yeah. American Hustle getting 0 out of 10 awards was surprising to me. But I can't think of one that I really, really thought it should win. But 0 out of 10 is pretty exceptional.
Mm-hmm. I thought the Great Gatsby and American Hustle would split those design awards. Although I guess Gatsby was the only one nominated for two. But I assumed American Hustle would get the bone of the costume design award thrown their way.
Nothing doing.
Yeah, I'm not upset. It's just the amount of time I have like casually heard, you know, Cineplex pre-shows talking about the fashion in that movie. I was just like, well, I guess that'll win the costume design award.
And the hair.
Yeah.
I literally based all of my Oscar picks on Cineplex pre-show jargon.
Every year when Fat Shia LaBeouf doesn't win Best Actor, I'm surprised.
Oh, here, okay.
Where were you again, Mark Saltzman? Where were you?
Where were you? This was my...
Is he not famous anymore, too?
Don't you talk about Mark Saltzman. Tech guru Mark Saltzman.
He listens to all the podcasts. So.
Tech guru.
Well, of course he does. He has 12 Bluetooths in his ear at any point in time.
And he's wearing 2 Bluetooth gloves.
And he's wearing a shirt made out of a tablet.
And his mouth is full of acorns he's saving for winter.
Oh, which is a related technological fact.
If you had told me at the beginning of this podcast that we would be shitting on Mark Saltzman, that's just money I would have lost on.
It's a night of Hollywood glitz and glamour, and also Mark Saltzman.
If we told you that, you wouldn't have been late to the podcast.
Yeah, no, I would have been on. I would have been here 4 hours ago. What did you guys think about Leo?
Leo not winning?
Shocking,
I don't know.
Not shocking.
I kind of thought he would win. I don't know, but I guess when they were announcing the nominees and a friend James and I were watching with was like, so who do you think is going to win? I started thinking about the fact that old people don't like The Wolf of Wall Street. And I was like, oh, yeah, he can't win. But up until then, I was pretty confident he was going to win. Then the last second, I was like, oh,
you had a blinding stroke of realization. R.E. old people.
That's what I call Oscar voters.
Yeah, well, you know,
because
what,
they're old people.
Did you read some of the – I read a couple of articles of members of the Academy had written based on their picks.
No.
Oh, my God. The system seems like the most absolutely insane voting system I've ever seen.
Yeah.
nothing compels them to watch all the films.
Great.
And nothing compels them to vote on every subject. So the one lady didn't vote for 12 Years a Slave because she didn't see it, because she didn't like violent movies and didn't want to be haunted by the imagery.
So it's a really important award that we can use to judge the year in film, like, is what you're saying.
And she said it unabashedly. She just said, oh, of course I did not watch that movie. And she said The Wolf of Wall Street was disgusting, and I did not care for it.
But she loved Philomena.
Oh, how not, though?
I will only watch films with Judi Dench in them.
Judi Dench playing somebody vulnerable. Don't give me that James Bond.
It's too much violence.
Too much violence. Oh, my goodness.
Well, my favorite Leo theory is that he goes his whole life without winning one, and then they do a biopic about him, and the person who plays Leo gets an Oscar for it.
I love that.
Okay, this is my theory, and I don't know if you guys subscribe to this as well, but my assumption is that if you, as a strong leading man type, if you play a gay character in Hollywood, you will win best leading man. Sean Penn won it for Milk. Philip Seymour Hoffman won it for Capote. Dallas Buyers Club, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Not gay in the movie, but sort of. I think you have to play somebody that is – I think gay is this new, like, edgy material in Hollywood.
Gay is the new Nicole Kidman's nose from The Hours.
And if you play to that and you – yeah, like, it is legitimate. That's – again, this is like a crackpot theory I have. But as far as I'm concerned, $20 says if Leo DiCaprio plays, like, a Philadelphia-style character in the next year, he will win an Oscar. And if he continues to play, like, hard, drug-addled men dealing with their own, like, inner psychoses, he will continue being nominated for Oscars, but he will not win them.
Well, I think Leo keeps playing those characters because he's tormented by his own inner psychoses about the fact that he's a man boy. And I think that's why he will continue to play tough people.
Oh, man. I wish. I would love to see it, though, to be totally honest. I would love to see Leonardo DiCaprio play something totally apart from the characters he has played.
Well, yeah, and it's sort of, I mean, it's the same as it's always been in that you have the upper hand over other nominees if voting, like if them voting for you makes them feel better about themselves. You
exactly.
know, like, it's like, oh, we beat racism. 12 Years a Slave, Best Picture.
Doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. Obama, 12 Years a Slave. Steve McQueen, we nailed it. We did it. 2014, we did it.
So, yeah, I mean, that's always being in a movie that makes the voters feel better about themselves will always help you.
It's one of those things, too, and I always get excited, and I do watch the Oscars every time, and then about 40 minutes into it, I go, man, I've really misplaced my emotions about this. Mm-hmm. I should have just torn my whole thing back and just not watched it at all.
I feel like most people go through that thought process. I used to until a couple years ago, and then I was just like, I just like watching the Oscars. I feel like they get it wrong every year, but I still just like watching it.
Yeah. See, for in that regard, I thought every winner, that was the one that I wanted to win in that sense. Mm-hmm. I thought they did. I thought Cate Blanchett was great. I like the fact that they don't just give the award to Meryl Streep every year. I appreciate that.
I love that Meryl Streep was like, oh, I'm just not winning this one. I can't believe I got nominated for this one.
She graciously accepts it every year, and she looks great.
Because she has like 15 already.
How many does she have actually, though? I didn't think I thought she only had like two.
I don't know the exact number, but I know it's enough.
It's like, I know she has 18 nominations. They mentioned it a bunch.
Yeah. Yeah, she's certainly been nominated a ton of times, but I didn't look up how many she's won.
Yeah. And a second question is, do you guys think Amy Adams is any good?
James and I have discussed this on the podcast. I am not her biggest fan, and I believe James isn't her biggest fan, but likes her quite a bit, right?
I'm literally her biggest fan.
Oh, okay.
No, no, not at all. No, I like her. I like her more than you do. I don't think she's amazing, but I think she's good. I think she's very good.
Okay. Because it confuses me every year. Every time I see her get nominated for something, I think. And then I watched it, too, because I hadn't seen it. Like, I think I've seen a couple of her movies, maybe two. And then I saw American Hustle, and I thought Jennifer Lawrence was very good in it. And then Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence and Christian Bale and Amy Adams all get nominated. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that is craziness. Amy Adams, I think just – I don't think they – like, she acted. I think they just filmed her kind of drunk for a little while.
I actually –
What about the British accent?
again, kind of drunk.
As far as Amy Adams' performances go, I did like her in American Hustle quite a bit. Because I felt like it was sort of, she knows her wheelhouse, and that wasn't outside of it. Like, her in The Fighter, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. But her in American Hustle is kind of where she should be.
Okay, I guess I can give you that. Because, yeah, it did seem like Amy Adams up there.
Because she just doesn't. She's one of those people that's like, she's like Bradley Cooper. She's good at the in between of comedy and drama, and she's not excellent at drama by itself. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So, just to clarify, Meryl Streep has won 3 Oscars.
Oh, okay.
Kramer versus Kramer, Sophie's Choice, and The Iron Lady.
Yeah, well, I mean,
she went 30 years in between wins.
Really?
Yeah, or 29 years.
Wow. And 29 nominations in between.
Somehow 30, actually.
Yes.
do you guys have anything more to add?
I'm glad we're not racist.
Yeah, that is good. I'm glad you and I aren't racist, but that Josh definitely is.
No, but Ellen said possibility number one was that 12 Years a Slave wins Best Picture, and possibility number two is that we're all racist, so... Yeah, I guess some of us can be racist. And it's you, Josh. Congrats.
Guys.
I did enjoy that Ellen got a dick joke in her monologue.
Are we just not... You guys aren't going to let me defend myself? But you just called me
racist? Oh, no, we're done. We're done with you.
So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin,
thanks
man.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin, man. Josh is racist. Tune in next week when he says anti-Semitic comments on air.
Yeah.
Look at this.
We're just muting your mic, and we're going to talk about 12 Years a Slave.
Damn it. I voted for Barkhad Abdi. I am a culturally sensitive, modern person. God damn. This has been the worst day ever.
Hate Jamie Foxx for some reason.
Okay, he's awful. He's very... Anyway, no.
Okay, that's fair. In Josh's defense, he just hates people with multiple X's that end their last names. Also not a big fan of Bubba Sparks.
And Amy Adams looks like 3/4 black at least.
And it's Adams with 3 S. Oh, Jesus, Bubba Sparks. Fuck.
Josh, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, never again.
I feel like you've said that every time you've been on the podcast. We just have to wait a few months for you to forget the pain that we put you through.
Yeah, it's the therapy will help me all out. I'll have PTSD for the next 2 weeks. So, all
right. And the racial sensitivity training will also help.
Guys, I'm not racist, guys. Please.
Guys, Josh isn't racist.
Please don't cut the podcast before you let me explain that I'm super not racist.
It's been long since cut.
Shit.
No, I'm just kidding. Thank you again for joining us, Josh.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Your NAACP Image Award is in the mail.
Oh, Jesse Jackson's going to be pissed.
All right, James, we finally got Josh out of here.
Finally.
Yeah. So now we're done talking about the ceremony, and now we can actually talk about the movie. 12 Years a Slave.
The big winner.
Yeah.
The movie that made it not racist because it won.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Ellen. I assume Gravity won more awards than 12 Years a Slave, right? Like, Gravity won the most awards?
Yeah, Gravity won 7.
Okay.
I think 12 Years a Slave won 3?
Yeah, that's... I can only think... Oh, yeah, I can think of 3. Yeah.
Yeah. Lupita for Best Supporting, Best Picture, and...
John Ridley for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Best Adapted Screenplay. Yeah. So, bigger awards than Gravity.
Yeah, well, I mean, Gravity won Best Director, though, so.
Yeah, Best Picture wins over that, though.
Yeah, but, yeah. Yeah, for sure. But, I mean, it's the second last award presented. Anyway, we're not talking about Alfonso Cuarón, we're talking about 12 Years a Slave.
We sure are.
Yeah.
how'd you like this movie?
I think this is, like, in my eyes, a very backhanded compliment. Outside of 2007, it's at least the best picture winner in like 25 years. But yeah, I mean, that's like the one thing that made me sort of stop and be like, maybe it's not better than Unforgiven. But I feel like I would give Unforgiven a lot of lead just because it's a Western and it's a cool movie. Even though I don't, the themes of the movie, I don't feel like hit home. But yeah, 12 Years a Slave is great. I think it's like 2/3 of a great movie. And oh boy, does it fall off the rails.
It's just the, like, it's for you at the 2/3 mark is when it falls off the rails?
Basically. And I mean, there's good stuff in the last act. I think Platt finally getting saved is a good scene. And like him riding away from the plantation. And I mean, just technically alone, the scene where Lupita Nyong'o is being whipped is incredible. But yeah, I think there's just a lot of look at us. We are saying things in the third act, you know?
Yeah. We both love Brad Pitt, but Brad Pitt showing up as Quaker Brad Pitt.
Oh, man. And saying the most idealistic lines every time he speaks.
Yeah, nothing but.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a little much for me. But yeah, with the, I was going to mention that shot of Patsy being whipped, but it's kind of showy, but not in a bad way. I thought that was nice, just this camera kind of circling and giving you a long take.
And it makes it so much more horrifying because there are no cuts.
Yeah, except all over her back.
Oh, come on.
That's serious. Okay. Obviously a very unpleasant movie, to say the least.
Yeah.
I saw it getting compared to Schindler's List and Passion of the Christ as kind of very unpleasant movies for people to watch. Mm-hmm. And from the standpoint of trying to get this movie made or get it funded or get it distributed, kind of the concern that maybe people aren't going to even show up for this movie, even if it's a well-made movie by well-respected people like a Spielberg or Steve McQueen.
And I mean...
Not the same, but it was still well-respected.
I assume none of Steve McQueen's previous films have been financially successful as well.
Right, yeah, that yes.
Another, that's a big difference between the two Steves.
Another concern for people, yeah, really.
He's got more bank as the dead actor than he does as the director of the two very good films he's made before.
Yeah. But point of, you know, when this movie hasn't even come out yet, whether or not people are going to come out to a long movie. Actually, this one isn't that long. I mean, it's over 2 hours, but it's 2:15, I think.
Yeah, that's like, this is probably like a 9-minute credit movie.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, but just a kind of unpleasant, very violent, vulgar times movie. And, you know, it has to be. So does Schindler's List. So does the way Mel Gibson wants to do Passion of the Christ. Mm-hmm. You're really not doing the story a service if you make it a PG film. but yeah, just the idea of doing something kind of this hard and still hoping people are going to show up for it. And mm-hmm. They have. I mean, people did go to this movie, and obviously with the Best Picture win, critics kind of gave it up for it too. So
yeah, critics, even aside from the ones with from within the Academy, did like this movie quite a bit. And I think what you're discussing, I think that mixed with is sort of what led to the things that happened in the third act. A number of the things that happened in the third act that I kind of have a problem with, you know.
Like, wow, what do you mean?
Which is sort of having...
dealing with the subject so heavy, you kind of have to have that part where you send your message really, really clearly.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's what Brad Pitt is. He's the message character, you know? Like, literally. Like, he literally delivers messages throughout the movie. or throughout his part of the movie. But yeah, I think that's where part of it comes out of, is this probably won't make money unless it wins Oscars, so we need to make sure it wins Oscars. That sort of conversation. Yeah?
Right.
Because Shame kind of has the same issues to a lesser extent towards its ending. Hunger did not at all. But yeah, and I think that's just sort of like, well, we know this cannot possibly make money, so we've got to make sure it wins an Oscar for us to make any money. You know?
Yeah. And then people will see it.
Yeah.
Is this your favorite Taron Killam movie of the year?
I can't think of another movie that he was in, so yes.
Good.
Yeah. It's not my favorite Taron Killam performance of the year, but...
Did you know he was going to be in this?
I had no idea, and when I saw this movie the first time on opening day back in November, I laughed out loud when I saw him because my immediate thought was there are two Brad Pitts in this movie. And like, it was instantaneous and I could not control the fact that I was laughing. Luckily, he appeared in the scene that he did.
Yeah, really? This guy shows up in the last 20 minutes of this movie, you're in trouble.
It would have been problematic.
Yeah.
For me, personally. Yeah.
And Paul Dano, who I keep loving.
Yeah, Paul Dano's good in everything.
Yeah, I'm glad.
Yeah.
So what else did you like about this movie, if you say kind of the first two-thirds or...
Well, I just sort of think it's... I like that, this applies to the whole movie, I think. I mean, it's really well made. I think Steve McQueen is a really good director that sometimes makes really bad decisions late in his films. But he's a very smart guy and he knows what he's doing. And one of the things I really like about this movie, there's a couple things throughout the candles, the use of candles and light being blown out and taken away from characters throughout the movie, I think is kind of a nice touch. Just sort of the fact that a flame is a pretty free flowing sort of thing. And, I mean, we first get it at the beginning where Solomon blows out the candle, in his bedroom to go to bed right before the title card back with his wife. And then when, Taron Killam and Scoot McNairy's characters are basically about to kidnap Solomon, Scoot McNairy blows out the candle. And there's another moment with Fassbender where right after, I think his name is Epps, finds out that Platt tried to get a letter through Garrett Dillahunt's character out saying who he actually was. And when Epps walks away from that scene, he takes the lantern with him and leaves Solomon in darkness, and then Solomon burning his letter and watching it burn the whole way down. I think the use of fire in that way is really, really interesting. And right before sort of Solomon gives up and gives in to where he is, when he buries that corpse and he just throws the dirt right on the camera, and that's another similar idea, you know?
Yeah, it's, I mean, you've kind of listed a bunch in a row, so it doesn't sound like it's the case, but I thought it was a visual metaphor that sometimes those upset us, I've noticed. I thought it was done sparingly enough. And...
Yeah, and I mean, that's all spread out pretty well. Like, I mean, going between Taron Killam and the Scoot McNairy example, that's probably at like the 15-minute mark of the movie, and then the Epps one and leading to Solomon burning the letter, that probably comes at like an hour and 45. And that's a long period of time in between them, you know?
Yeah, that's what I mean. That I think those kinds of metaphors can seem really heavy, really heavy-handed.
Yeah.
And I think this one just wasn't, like, was handled well. And
that's for sure.
Steve McQueen just knowing what he's doing.
Yeah, and I love the shot of the letter burning all the way down. I think it's such a good shot. And it's such a good shot for what it's trying to convey meaning wise. And also it's just gorgeous. I've never seen something like that. And it's just sort of like this little bit of light just finally disappearing from the frame, I think is really nice.
Yeah. And it's, and you watch the letter go away entirely, which I don't know. I've seen letters burn in movies before. And for some reason it seems like you just kind of see them burn and then that's that. But this one, you go until there's just nothing left and it's completely hopeless for him at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another thing I like about Steve McQueen. He, his films never lack patience. They're never slow, but they're always patient. Like, he knows when to take the time.
Yeah. You mentioned the shot of, Solomon once he's free or on his way to freedom, at least when he's leaving, the plantation on that carriage with the other people, and that's a really long shot of his face, and you never get a smile, you never get a sense of relief. Like, it seems still just so traumatic that it doesn't seem like he knows he's in the clear, but he still can't process it or something.
Well,
like,
yeah, and that's
the long shot, and you never kind of get that one moment of relief. And understandably, Solomon doesn't smile in this movie outside of the time while he's still with his family before he's been, you know, kidnapped and sold.
Yeah.
understandably, I mean, he's going through something awful. But even after that, it's, you never kind of get that moment of catharsis. Even as it's taken a positive turn, you never get that moment where a protagonist seems to have been relieved, so the audience can kind of exhale with him.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of, and I mean, he doesn't even smile when he gets back with his family because he still feels so shitty. That's the thing I think is possible, is one of the more, or is possibly the most interesting thing about this movie, is the idea of turning your back on something. And that's another visual metaphor that we get a lot in this movie. And the effect that can have on somebody's psyche, just sort of being at a place where you kind of know you can't do anything about it, so it's just best to just walk away from it. And I mean, Solomon explains this to Paul Dano's character when he's building the house, before Paul Dano beats him and they have their little fight. He says it's all a matter of perspective. And the last line of the movie is Solomon asking, I think it's his daughter that he's speaking to at this point. He says, "Forgive me." And she says, "There's nothing to forgive." And the idea is sort of like he didn't have a choice but to be self-interested. Like he spends a lot of the movie talking about how, you know, he's not going to give up what makes him just to survive, even though that's what he does by the end of the movie. And I think the idea of that idea is really interesting. And we even sort of get that flashback to him in the store from before he's kidnapped, where that character whose name is Jasper comes in into the store and is just so confused by the fact that there's a black family just walking around in a store and there doesn't seem to be any problem with it. Yeah. And Solomon basically, he doesn't like literally turn his back in that scene to him, but there's some ignorance going on there just out of self-interest. And I think that's the really interesting thing about this movie, is what you can ignore for your own self-interest. And I think one of the shots that really drives this home, not necessarily the turning your back scene, but the scene where Solomon is being hanged and he's just sort of keeping himself up with the toes, like with his toes. Yeah, it's impossible to watch. But we get sort of like 30 seconds where there's nobody in the background, and then 30 seconds where everybody just goes out and does their business. Like there are kids playing behind him. Yeah, and I think that really sums up that element of the movie, you know?
Him just being on his toes with only mud under him, too. Like, just thinking about how easily it could just slip out from under him.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, yikes. What do you make of the scene where he breaks his violin? Was that him giving up, or what?
That is, yes. That's part of the third act that I'm not a fan of, because I think that's where we get the visual metaphors going a bit too far, because throughout the movie, what makes him stand out is the fact that he's a musician. And it's sort of the violin throughout the movie is representative of things that Solomon can do that others don't have the talent for or the ability to. Like, he gets that violin from Benedict Cumberbatch's character after he uses his intelligence to sort of devise a better way to do his work. And Cumberbatch, you know, pays him with this violin. And so it's very much, he gets it for one aspect of being Solomon, and he destroys it because he kind of feels like Solomon's gone at that point. And this is either right before or right after he sort of joins in with the singing, that sort of long take, the group singing. And I think that's sort of the moment where he's just like, he just resigns. And I like that scene a lot. And the violin is that, but in a more over-the-top sort of way.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the violin also points to his kind of old cultured life.
Where exactly.
You know, someone in appeared to have somewhat, I don't want to say elite status, but was, you know, more in the high culture crowd back in Saratoga.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you like that shot of the three-colored sky?
Oh, yeah.
I thought that'd be something you'd appreciate.
Yeah, I mean... it's weird saying that this might be Steve McQueen's made three movies. This might be his least gorgeous, and it's still so gorgeous, visually. Sean Bobbitt, his DOP, is very talented. He shot The Place Beyond the Pines as well, which is something you've seen.
Something I've seen and something I've loved.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What do you think of this take on the movie that following Northrop, following a black person who didn't really have the full slave experience, is kind of a cop out? Have you heard this angle on this movie yet?
I have not. I don't know. I suppose I don't have opinions on it. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't thought about it at all.
Okay, but you hadn't heard that?
No. I haven't read a lot about this movie.
Okay, because this was kind of one of the, I don't know, mini controversies. When something this political or this socially charged and racially charged comes out, there's always a lot of very different readings of it. But yeah, I guess the idea with this one is, for, you know, mass white audiences, we needed a story that's framed kind of on an individual scale, because the white population never had this for their whole population, like the whole society. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a nightmare to be put into this group of people the way that Solomon is, someone he doesn't belong with. And it's kind of the argument is that it's kind of separating Solomon from the rest of the black population at the expense of in order to kind of let white people into those shoes. We could handle 12 years a slave, but you know, we wouldn't want
42.
Lifetime a slave, or hundreds of years of slave for millions of slaves. It comes down to this idea that he's exceptional, and that it's not about the black population of America at that time. It's about, you know, the white nightmare of being confused as someone who can be put into this other category.
I certainly see that argument, but I also kind of feel like the things, and maybe I'm playing into this argument, the things that make this movie good kind of rely on Solomon having lived a totally different life. What I was talking about, like what you're able to turn your back to, I think that's so much more interesting because he's lived two entirely different kinds of lives. So maybe, yeah, I'm part of the problem, but, do think that's what makes this movie different, you know, and good.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you appreciate that as a theme outside of the slavery.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't have to be the case. But what you're saying is he kind of has to have another life to turn his back on to have that theme of turning your back on things.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else about 12 Years a Slave?
Well, we didn't. I meant to mention the close-up. There are a number of close-ups in this movie from kind of odd perspectives, and that sort of ties into what I was saying about it's all about perspective, it's all about how you look at things. This is something McQueen does throughout his films generally. This one has actually the least of it, but it plays into the themes of this film more than anything. Like we get the shot of the plate in the very beginning of the movie, Solomon's plate of food, and he's sort of like playing with the juice from the berries on his plate a little bit. Yeah. And we get a repeat of that shot later, and it's sort of like these weird perspective shots from angles that we wouldn't think of. And we get that really good one of the boat and the wake behind it early on as well. I think the first shot of the movie is a camera pushing through the cane and I think those shots sort of really add a nice element to it, like the it's all about perspective element.
Yeah, you know? the camera coming up through the the steamboat wheel is pretty cool.
It's very cool. And I mean, obviously, it's not a real boat. You know, like there's just no way you could have gotten a camera there. And I think that sort of that adds a nice element. You know?
Yeah. And that's another long shot that maybe shows McQueen's patience a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, we didn't even talk about my favorite long take in the movie. Because this is a scene that I think really sort of shows the power of the long takes, because it's not as immediately like violently horrifying, despite it being a super horrifying scene, is the long scene where long take with Paul Giamatti's character when he's having his slave auction is. It's such a long take, and it's so it's so well blocked out, and devolves into the most horrifying thing, like the mom screaming, "Don't split me up from my kids," and Paul Giamatti saying to Solomon, play music, like it's so horrifying without being the most violent scene in the movie, and I think that scene's really really impressive and really, really good.
Yeah. It's the other kind of horrifying that comes out of slavery.
Yeah, exactly.
The non-violent kind, but still absolutely terrible. And
yeah. And that scene sort of gives you time to really, again, with the long take, without ever breaking and without ever making you think of a new setup, a new camera angle, it sort of really sinks you into this sort of thought process that is normalized. And is crazy. And I think that scene works out really well. And from a technical perspective, all the actors, you know, there's so much stress on you in a long take as an actor and as a crew member. That's always really impressive to me, and is always worth it.
Yeah. And the other long take we talked about with Patsy getting chained to the tree and whipped. Mm-hmm. Kind of by the second time you circle that tree, you're kind of made aware that this is going to be a long take, or that it has been a long take already. Mm-hmm. And I find that different than this, the one you're describing there early on with Paul Giamatti. You know, it's not like the long take in Goodfellas where you cover a lot of ground, you know, where you're going from outside to through the kitchen to through all the seats to the very front. Like it's geographic. Three rooms, but it's the long take of just going back and forth, and as you said, just having it perfectly blocked. And then I think you're right, it gets you in that headspace where everything is normal and these people are just doing their business, and just, you know, the banality of evil, how normal all of these atrocious acts were at the time.
Yeah, exactly. And and even just in sort of to sort of further what you're talking about, in preparation for this podcast, I watched Hunger and Shame again. And there's a 17-minute take in Hunger that's just two people sitting down and having a conversation at a table, and the camera never moves, but it's still just sort of, it's so engrossing, and you sort of get to look at the frame in such a weird sort of way because you're staring at it for so long. You start to notice weird lines in it and stuff. And even if there's no real elements of the shot motion wise, and it's just sort of a part of the scene. I watched E2 Mama Tambien recently as well, and it's an Alfonso Cuarón movie without action sequences, so the most impressive long takes are all in the dialogue scenes, and they always really, really suck you in, even if there's nothing big and exciting happening in the frame. And every director should do more long takes, basically.
And use Taron Killam and Scoot McNairy more often.
Yeah. I want to just tell you something about Steve McQueen, because I feel like you might enjoy this. It's
beefing with the screenwriter.
Is he actually?
Yeah. Did you not see this?
No.
Either?
No, I didn't.
Neither of them thanked each other during their speech, and they just kind of walked past each other on their way to the stage, too.
That's funny.
I guess they're fighting over who gets the credit for the gets full credit for the writing.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
I guess McQueen asked Ridley for a shared credit, which he denied.
Huh. That's interesting, because John Ridley, I forget what else like he hasn't done anything that I've thought was good. And the movie I saw that he directed, wrote and directed recently, the Jimi Hendrix biopic with Andre 3000 was garbage. So that's really interesting. And I did not know that, but it makes sense.
Okay, but what else about Steve actually going to say?
It's kind of funny the way people talk about Steve McQueen and like other directors as well, because he has a background in visual art, but you know film based, and there was. It seems like every time another director says something complimentary to his face, they always mention the fact that he's from the art world, like it's some big holy place. Like the most interesting example to me is the Hollywood Roundtable that gets done every year with, you know, actors and writers and then directors. It was like Alfonso Cuarón, David O. Russell, Steve McQueen, Ben Stiller was there, and one other director who I can't remember. But they're all talking about Steve McQueen, and everyone and mentions, it's like, well, you make really beautiful films because you're from the art world. And Steve McQueen is so visually upset every time this gets brought up. Like, he's just like, what is wrong with you people? And it's just sort of this way people look at Steve McQueen that he thinks is silly because you're all using the same tools. He just has different training. Whereas Alfonso, like somebody that never went to film school, it's like, well, how did you get learned? And it's just like, you all have the same tools. So I scoff at you for thinking I'm better just because I had a different schooling than you. And I enjoy other directors always bowing down to his artsiness. And I even more love Steve McQueen looking so upset whenever people bring it up, and like angry upset. It makes me so happy.
Yeah, maybe just feels, it's kind of a cop-out for other people.
It's definitely a cop-out for other people. It's like they're saying, I can't do this because I didn't go to art school, which is insane.
Yeah.
We didn't actually talk if you actually like 12 Years a Slave, and I am curious to know what you think.
Yeah, I liked it. It sounds like I like it less than you do, but I like it more than I thought I was going to, we'll say.
Okay, that's good.
All the super politicized movies,
they're all problematic in some way, yeah.
Well, yeah, they're all problematic, and, at the risk of sounding bad, I wonder if it's just more of, you know, we should respect a movie about this subject matter to not look one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Like, I would not just say that about 12 Years a Slave and racism, but about, you know, Schindler's List and, you know, oh, you don't like it? You're a Holocaust denier. Like, it's a cheap argument, but
I think it's a valid argument, though. Because, I mean, we talked about this with Josh. It's sort of the advantage in Academy voting always goes to the thing that makes them feel like a better person for voting for it, you know? And I think that 100% exists, and I don't know. I think it's fine to say.
Yeah, it's just, as bad as it's at, like, my concern is that I'm, you know, at fear of being prejudged, I'm also making prejudgments about a movie, which doesn't, which, you know, just feels hypocritical and bad. But, anything kind of super socially or politically charged, I'm always wondering if this is a good movie or if this is a movie about a subject that you feel you have to call good. Or it's the same thing with, complicated movies or like deep, dark movies. People don't want to say they don't like it for the risk of sounding too dumb to have understood it. So it's like, oh, this looks like it should be a smart movie. I'm going to say I like it so I don't look like a dumb.
Yep.
Maybe that was beneficial for my appreciation of 12 Years a Slave, because part of me was just
what?
Maybe this is just resigned to the fact that this is a issue movie, and that's all it has going for it, but it has more going for it than that by a long shot. So
definitely. So in closing, I just want to say you are very happy that the Dallas Buyers Club did not win Best Picture.
Yeah, that's all issue movie.
Oh, I did not like that film.
I heard that.
But thank you for listening to MacGuffman. Be sure to check back tomorrow. We'll have a new podcast about another film starring Lupita Nyong'o and Scoot McNairy. So be sure to check back for what that is.
What could it be?
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.